the thing that made sense to call it Patrick's Cabaret was about the artists taking the means of production into their own hands. Okay, so instead of me, I'm the working class artist, I'm the dancer, I've made a piece, and I go and I try to get some art organization to present my piece, I like bust that paradigm apart and I take the means of production into my own hands.
Hello. I hope you're doing well.
You are listening to the Ghosts and Horses Radio Hour con Brian Bieber.
I've got Bieber fever.
Awkward subjects comfortably discussed.
Hey everybody, it's me again, Brian Bieber, and it's this again, the Ghosts and Horses Radio Hour. A few weeks ago, I had the pleasure of spending an afternoon talking with Patrick Scully, the founder of the Minneapolis performance venue and nonprofit arts organization Patrick's Cabaret. A little later, Patrick and I will be talking about the origins of Patrick's Cabaret and its mission, but before we talk too much about the organization, I would like to introduce you to the man. As an artist and an arts advocate, Patrick has worn a number of different hats over the years. He's a dancer, a storyteller, and a multidisciplinary performance artist with a catalog of performance production and award credits that is literally too long to list on this show. But you can read about all of that stuff on Patrick's website after you're done listening to the show if you want. For now, I'm just going to let Patrick introduce himself by playing this clip where he tells the story about how he became a storyteller.
Storytelling, yeah, you know the.
Because I think that's primarily what I've known you to do.
Yeah,
when I've seen you perform, it's been telling stories.
You know, the storytelling evolved over time, but I think the first, really probably the, my first significant foray into storytelling was there was a theater group from San Francisco that was coming to Minneapolis and was going to perform. And they were going to perform in the space at St. Stephen's School, the same space that the cabaret first started in. But their show was only about 45 minutes long. And so they asked me, did I have something else? Either did I know somebody or was there... Because they felt like that wasn't enough of a show to invite an audience to for just 45 minutes. And I decided that I was going to tell the story of this artist in the school's residency from hell, where I went up to East Grand Forks, Minnesota, in the dead of January winter, and almost got run out of town. And eventually that whole story I came to refer to as a fairy home companion. And it's a story actually that I've told many times, and it involves not only the sort of problems and events of my 2 weeks in East Grand Forks, but on the weekend in between, I decided to go stay and visit the friend of a friend who was living in Fargo. And in Fargo, there wasn't a lot happening on Friday night, but that Saturday night, the Prairie Gay community was having a dance in Wolverton, Minnesota.
And what year was this?
19... maybe 81?
Okay.
Something like that.
Was there a pretty large gay community in Fargo for?
No.
I mean, the gay
community in Fargo was pretty small, okay. And the gay community in Wolverton was even smaller.
Yeah.
I mean, Wolverton is only a population of 144 people, and it's in Minnesota.
So statistically.
But statistically, they were at more than one, but less than 2%, because there were two gay men who lived in Wolverton, one of whom had grown up there, and then his partner, and they bought the old four-room schoolhouse, and it was mostly used as like a senior day activity center. Okay. But they decided they were going to have this gay and lesbian dance, and host it for the Prairie Gay community. And so I went with my host from Fargo and some of his friends. We got in the car, and you know, it's that squeaky cold where you step on the snow and it all kind of sounds like styrofoam underneath your feet, and at least 20 below zero. And but we get there to Wolverton, and you see people, you know, drag queens dashing in their high-heeled sandals across the icy streets and up and into the building, and get inside, and Michael Jackson is playing, and people are dancing and having a good time. Until at one point I look out the window and I see this mob of people walking down the street. And somehow the citizens of Wolverton had found out that this gay and lesbian dance was happening in their town, and they came to let everybody know that they did not think that this was all right. And in my memory of it, you know, I see like people carrying torches and shotguns, and they weren't, but it felt like a lynch mob showing up at the front door. And so anyhow, A Fairy Home Companion is the story of the confrontation that night between those of us there at the dance and the town of Wolverton and the amazing sheriff of Pemberton County, who basically showed up and said to the angry town folk, "These people are exercising their constitutional right to freedom of assembly, so either clear out of this front entryway because you're creating a public nuisance and a safety hazard, either pay $5 to go into the dance or go home." And I thought, this is amazing. Yeah. I mean, not even 15 years after Stonewall, and this small town sheriff in Minnesota is quoting the United States Constitution to basically allow this gay and lesbian dance to keep happening.
Yeah, that's not bad for 1981.
Yeah, you know? No, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
But I remember as I stood on that stage in St. Stephen's in the auditorium, and I thought, well, I trust my ability to dance, and so if I start telling this story and it doesn't feel like the audience is with me, then I'm just going to bail on the story and just dance and create this improv piece. But the story really, really worked. And then I think that what happened was then from there, as I, after that, created the opportunity for myself in the shows that I was doing that became Patrick's Cabaret, I was, for the first 3 years there in that same school auditorium that I knew really well because I also taught there in the school. And then when we moved and were in the storefront that was also my apartment, I was as at home as I could ever be in a space because it was my space.
Yeah.
And I was inviting all of these people as performers and as audience into my space. And it created for me the opportunity to just talk a little more on stage. And I think that then the storytelling that I've come to do more and more of as a performer grew out of that initial impulse that caused me to leave Contact Works, which was I wanted to ground my work on stage more in some of the specific and explicit reality of my life as a gay man. And obviously that story, The Fairy Home Companion, it had everything to do that. I was this out gay artist in this small town, East Grand Forks, where they were freaking out, thinking, we have brought Beelzebub himself into our midst. We have to keep an eye on him everywhere he goes. Mm. And then I get a weekend where I think I get to escape to Fargo and let off some steam, and then it crystallizes even more in Wolverton, Minnesota. And, you know, and so the stories, they just kept coming because interesting stuff kept happening in my life, and I just reflect on it on stage.
Here's how the shows at Patrick's Cabaret work. Twice a month, the cabaret's program director schedules an evening of performances from artists of various disciplines. A large part of the cabaret's mission is supporting the development of artists by encouraging them to take risks and present works in progress on stage. Each performer gets about 15 minutes of stage time to do with whatever they'd like, and there are no auditions.
The idea behind the first one was I had been working, and I think it was actually with a couple musicians, and we'd been getting together like once a week for quite a while and improvising, and I thought it would be fun to just invite an audience in to do this. But what we were working on wasn't enough to like do a whole evening of, and so I thought, why don't I just call other artists that I know and see who else has got something that they're working on that they'd like to show people? And so I did. I just went through my, I don't know if it was back in those days, a little phone book or a Rolodex or whatever, and just called anybody that I knew that I thought, you know, and some were writers, some were poets, some were storytellers, some were musicians, some were dancers, and just said, you know, do you have something? Would you like to do this show together? This is my idea, is that, you know, we'll just put together flyers and invite people and keep the price really low so that people can just have a chance to come and see our work. And then, you know, it's the first chance to sort of put things up before an audience. And so that was the idea, really, was to just my first impulse was I had some stuff I wanted to show people. Second impulse was I don't have enough stuff to do a whole show. How could I make this into a show? And I really sort of stole the model from the choreographer's evening at the Walker of several different artists sharing an evening that I was very familiar with. And then I just tore off the choreographer's label, and it was anything that might be on stage instead of just dance.
And so then, so it was 3 years at Stevens, and it just kind of, or St. Stevens, and it just kind of built on itself, and then...
Yeah, you know, I mean, it just kind of, we'd do one show, and then do another, and then at some point, I believe it was Sue Halloran said to me at one point, you know, Patrick, everybody else in town calls this Patrick's Cabaret, and you should, like, stop searching for a name for it and just let it have the name that everybody else has already given it. So I said, okay.
The show started in the gymnasium of the St. Stephen's School in Minneapolis and went on semi-regularly there for about 3 years. At that point, Patrick's Cabaret moved from the school to Patrick's own home, a large storefront loft on 24th Street. After nearly a decade of regular performances in the 24th Street Loft, the city of Minneapolis shut Patrick's Cabaret down for hosting performances in a space zoned as residential. Around this time, Patrick's Cabaret officially became a nonprofit arts organization, and a generous donor, who would later become known to the cabaret and its supporters as the Fairy Godmother, purchased the building in which the cabaret resides today. In the 2 decades before it was Patrick's Cabaret, the building was a furniture store. In the 1960s, it was a performance space called the Firehouse Theater. In the 1890s, it was an actual firehouse. The stage on which performances take place today occupies what used to be stables for the horses that pulled the firehouse's water wagons. So the place definitely has some history. Within weeks of obtaining the building and beginning renovations in 1999, Patrick's Cabaret performances began, and have continued twice a month, like clockwork, ever since. These days, Patrick's title at Patrick's Cabaret is Artistic Director, and he serves mostly as an advisor to the cabaret's full-time staff, while he pursues his own work. The shows are now typically curated by Arturo Miles, the cabaret's program director.
But to me, the thing that made sense to call it Patrick's Cabaret was, and this is from a very Marxian point of view, was about the artists taking the means of production into their own hands. Okay, so instead of me, I'm the working class artist, I'm the dancer, I've made a piece, and I go and I try to get some art organization to present my piece. So, you know, I'm in that sort of relationship of creator to the field. I like bust that paradigm apart, and I take the means of production into my own hands. So I don't have to get the Walker to produce it, or Northrop, or Intermedia Arts, or somebody else. It's like, I'm just going to do it myself. And now, artists had done that a lot in terms of just self-producing their own show. But what was unique in starting to do the cabarets here was to sort of band together with other artists and do a shared show in that way. Because one of the things often happens if you do a show of your own, your circle of who you're going to draw is only so big.
Right.
And so you might have a house of 20 people. But if six artists get together and do a show and they each bring 20 people, then you've got a house of 120 people.
Right.
And that's more than you've got chairs.
And, yep, and, that's
and so then it feels
circle.
Crowded and,
yeah.
and the sort of critical mass grows and the excitement grows. And so I feel proud that both cabaret means something unique in this community, and I think it means that in large part because of what was started with this cabaret. But I also feel proud in that it developed with a sense of historical consciousness of the fact that I was not doing something that had never been done before. I was doing something actually in the late 1980s when I started the cabaret that artists were doing in Europe 100 years before that.
Mm.
So I was carrying on like a century-old tradition.
And that sort of Marxist sensibility carries over too into the no. Is there still a no audition policy? Yeah. So it's just it's kind of an open call thing. So what's the process for booking? Does it remain the same?
It stays the same. You know, I mean, when Arturo gets on stage now, he says, you know, we've got these open call cabarets, and they're open to anybody, and all you have to do to be in one is, you know, send me an email or talk to me after the show or give me a call, and we'll look at the calendar and figure out, you know, when's the best time that you to fit you into the mix.
And the kind of crazy and great thing about that format is it feels like such a grab bag. Like, you go to the show and you never know what exactly you're going to see. And so there are times where, I mean, I've seen some you know, pretty rocky performances or things that are, which
there's
is kind
some,
of
some
of,
disastrous
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah,
and, there's some stuff that's utter failures.
And then every once in a while, though, you see something that you never expected to see that just is that's just mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's one of the great things.
But you know, the truth is, you could see something that's just as disastrous at the Walker or the Guthrie or someplace else. You know, because that's the nature of art, is that you're taking a chance. It's risk taking, and I've always contended two things. First, that if you're going to discover diamonds, you also have to make room for horse shit. Okay, you can't find diamonds if there is no horseshit. Okay, and secondly, that people do their most interesting work. They're most likely to actually create that diamond if you let them do whatever they want to do. If they're not trying to please me as the presenter, but I just tell them, well, ask them, what do you want to do? That's what I want you to do. I found out that I was HIV positive in the fall of 1985. I went to get tested. The test had only been out for a couple months, and there was generally a waiting line, you know, waiting list, so you'd call and make an appointment several weeks in advance to, and you know, this was 1985. I had been sexually active for more than a decade as a gay man, and much of that was, you know, in a period of time before anybody knew anything about AIDS, much less safe sex.
Mm-hmm.
Even when we first knew that people were dying, we didn't know that it was a sexually transmitted virus. And so when I went to get tested, I went thinking, I'm probably going to be positive.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I just figured, you know, I'd been around the block enough times, and it was very likely that I'd been exposed to the virus at some point.
Did you know a lot of people at that point who were positive?
I knew a few people who were positive. Most people at that time who were positive weren't out about it. I mean, probably that's still true, but then it must probably even more the exception that somebody would be out about it unless they were already sick. But at the time that I tested positive, I also, you know, as an undergraduate, my degree was in biology, and I knew enough about life science to know that not every time one organism gets infected by another organism does the same result happen. And so I just thought, you know, I'm not going to get sick. You know, this is something I have to pay attention to, and I'm going to have to deal with it, but I'm not planning to die from it. And maybe it was arrogance, maybe it was denial, maybe it was brilliant intuition, who knows? But so far it's turned out to be, you know, that I was right. And having that attitude, along with some other choices that I made to just try to live in ways that I thought were really healthy, I never was faced with the intense pressure of trying to find some medication now because I was sick. Mm. You know, I was feeling healthy enough that I didn't feel like I needed to do anything immediately to deal with being HIV positive. And what that meant was, from when I found out I was positive until I started taking my first medications, more than 11 years passed. And fortunately, during those 11 years, they finally, toward the end, in that 11th year, they finally came up with combinations of drugs for dealing with HIV that were effective. And I was lucky that I hadn't taken any of those drugs individually before then, because many people who did took them one by one. If you're only taking one of them, then the virus builds up an ability to mutate and evolve so that then you become the virus becomes resistant to that drug. So then one by one you sort of create this super virus in yourself that then there's no drug combination that can knock it out. So I was lucky to have followed the path that I did.
How much has that like played into your art as you've created it? I
know
it's kind of hard to
It's easy to answer that. It's maybe easier than you imagine. In the same way that being a gay man allowed me to be conscious of my outsider role in relationship to the larger society that I lived in. And by that I mean things as specific as being attacked by somebody whose intention was to kill a faggot, to living in a state where sodomy was a felony. You know, for most of my life in Minnesota, that was the case. And so, you know, there's this way in which when the very essence of your life is illegal, you know, the expression of your sexual desire, there's a way in which it then causes you to look at not just the legal system, but all of the structures that surround you in the society in which you live, and question all of it. And I think that questioning, that willingness to question it, is really healthy for an artist. I think that questioning causes me to not only create work, it causes me to create an institution like Patrick's Cabaret. To say, you know what, there isn't an organization in town that supports me to just do my work in the way that I want to, well then I'll just create that organization. Not that I sort of started out from the beginning, but I had an openness of mind that allowed that to evolve. In the same way, being HIV positive, in the early years of the epidemic, when gay men were dying at an alarming rate, you know, the city of Minneapolis was spending more money to fight Dutch elm disease than it was to deal with AIDS. And the federal government wasn't doing anything. And President Reagan went for years without ever saying AIDS. And it was as if there was this unspoken war going on in this country. So now I take what I'd learned as a sort of gay man who came out very shortly after Stonewall, which was 1969. I came out, and first people I told that I was gay would have been in 72. I took that kind of young activist post-Stonewall consciousness, and then it was crystallized by, this isn't just like sometimes some of us are getting attacked and sometimes we're facing discrimination. This was now, we are dying. We are being attacked by this virus and nobody's doing anything. Unlike when toxic shock happened, or Legionnaires' disease, or other things when people, you know, there were these new phenomena in the CDC and the State Health Department, and everybody would like react and, you know, spend lots of money and try to figure out what was going on. Faggots were dying, and nobody wanted to even talk about it. You know, there was this sort of conspiracy of silence. And so that very definitely informed my work. You know, in the first couple years after I found out I was positive, I didn't share with a lot of people that I was HIV positive, mostly because I didn't want to deal with the expectation that I was going to get sick and die soon. And that was the general cultural assumption of anybody who was HIV positive. Well, you know, better start preparing your will and, yeah, you know, preparing yourself to no longer be here. I didn't want to live in a world where I was on a daily basis being surrounded by people who were expecting me to die. But within 5 years, by like 1990, I was explicitly identifying myself and my work as an HIV positive gay man. And in the years preceding 1990, I was already dealing with HIV and AIDS as a topic in the work that I was doing. So like with David Lindahl, we did a show together called Survival Symptoms. And it had sort of seven sections, and it was, they were just different, different looking at different aspects of life through the eyes of two men who were living with HIV. So it affected my work content-wise. It also affected my work in terms of a kind of radicalization, you know, so that a lot of the work that I did was both gay-identified and activist-identified and HIV as, and identified then also much of the time as somebody living with HIV.
This summer, Patrick's Cabaret celebrated its 25th anniversary. There's a day-long block party, workshops, a parade through Minneapolis's Longfellow neighborhood where the cabaret is located, and performances from dozens of artists and musicians. Some of the performers have been a part of the Patrick's Cabaret community for decades. Others were born years after the cabaret started.
I was actually talking with Howard Lieberman. He's an attorney and a performance artist, and I was saying, you know, the interest, he was telling me that like this year in the Fringe Festival there are only five shows that have any nudity in it. And I said, well, you know, 2011 is not 1998 or 2001 even. We've been living for a decade now in a country where the government has nurtured a climate of fear. And I think that makes a real difference in the work that people put out in the world, and also in the work that artists do in the world. And there may be some artists who recognize that and consciously confront that, but there are, I think, going to be lots of artists who aren't even going to be aware of it, who, let's say, were 10 when 2001 was here, and now they're 20 and they're starting to create work, sing songs, whatever, but they've lived their whole sort of conscious life in America during this time of so much fear. And I think that changes the nature of work that people bring to the cabaret. But in a way, it makes it all the more important that there be a space where there's not somebody else's filter that you have to get through before you get to get on stage, where people still have the freedom to do whatever it is that they want to do, because 2011 isn't 2001, isn't 1991, isn't 1986. You know, this is today. And so we have to deal with today. And it's interesting having an historical perspective on, you know, 25 years of looking back over Patrick's Cabaret and realizing that, wow, there was a time like in the early and mid-90s where people's awareness of their cultural identity, whether it be straight white male identity or gay white male or black gay lesbian, black lesbian or whatever, you know, where the confluence of race and gender and sexual preference and class and ability, where people were really sort of trying to make that trying to make that visible, trying to make that clear, and how that played out in their lives. And maybe that's not a thing that gets so much attention today. And it's not good or bad, it's just different. And maybe, you know, I think there's some people who think, oh, maybe the stuff that's happening now at the cabaret isn't as edgy as things were, but the point was never to be edgy. The point was to just be honest, you know, and if that honestness comes out as edgy, or if that honestness comes out as comforting, you know, and so I just wanted to take a moment and reflect on that, because the mission of the organization to support artists in creating new work stays the same, and then the time that mission is manifested in as we move through history, how it gets manifested is going to change depending upon who the people and the times are. And it's interesting to have been an organization that's around for long enough that one can see changes.
This has been the Ghosts and Horses Radio Hour, and I've been your host, Brian Bieber. Big thanks this month to Patrick Scully. You can find out more about Patrick and his work at patrickscully.org, and you can find out what's happening at Patrick's Cabaret and how to perform there if you like by going to patrickscabaret.org. The Ghosts and Horses Radio Hour logo was designed by Christy Corver, and the Ghosts and Horses Radio Hour theme is made up of Tiny Lights by Wheel Off Hooks for Hands. You heard additional music in this episode from Andrew W.K.'s collection of piano improvisations, 55 Cadillac. If you haven't already, you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. And if you like the show, please go ahead and leave a nice review while you're there. And if you don't like the show, then please don't bother leaving a review, because I know we've been over this before, but, I mean, what's the point of that, really? You can download past episodes and bonus content at ghostsandhorses.com. There you'll also find links to work by past guests of the show. And while you're there, you can also check out some of the other stuff that I've gotten up to, like the series of letters I wrote to minor celebrities about formative moments in my personal history. If you have questions about the show or suggestions for future guests, you can email me directly at ghostsandhorses@gmail.com. As always, thanks for listening.
Actually, when I told her I found a building, and she said, "And how much is it?" And I said, $250,000. And she said, "Well, did you hear what happened to the Asian stock markets today?"